Collins.
Look, Mom, no cavities. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, May 7th, 2019. And yes, I just came from the dentist. No Novocaine, no fillings, no cavities. That's always a happy outcome. As I mentioned yesterday, I'm going to take a week off starting Thursday, so tomorrow will be my last podcast this week, and I'll resume on Friday, the 17th of May. Two interesting articles surfaced in the last 48 hours, triggered by the release of the Mueller report, redacted as it is. And both of them challenge it from different directions. But for my progressive friends who don't dabble in media that comes from the right, and there's a lot of it, you might be in for some surprises. A Russiagate 2.0, where the focus is on the role of the deep state, the intelligence community in particular, in creating what Trump has called a hoax, a witch hunt. And I know people don't want to hear that. You think that that's part of Trump's package of lies. And he lies a lot. And he even lies about things that he's trying to tell the truth about, because he is a compulsive kind of liar. Let me turn first to Gareth Porter's detailed look at the Mueller investigations report. It's a truth out, and I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. And he says that while Mueller didn't find evidence of the so-called collusion conspiracy, Mueller's report is bound to prolong the U.S. political obsession with the Trump-Russia collusion narrative, because it keeps alive the idea that Trump campaign contacts with Russians were a threat to U.S. national security. And I will add, Mr. Porter, that the executive summary, which opens with Mueller's report, the claim that there was a sweeping effort to influence our election, sweeping and systematic, I consider that to be a huge exaggeration. Back to Porter, the continued focus on the collusion narrative also plays into the hands of the national security state and powerful arms contractors who have stoked the new Cold War with Russia. They view Trump as a threat after he declared in his first major foreign policy address in April of 2016, quote, "We desire to live peacefully and in friendship with Russia and China." And shortly after he stepped down as Obama's CIA director in January of 17, John Brennan brushed back Trump with this public quote. "I think Trump has to understand that absolving Russia of various actions that it's taken in the past number of years is a road that he, I think, needs to be very, very careful about moving down." So that was a threat. And that feeds the argument, the scenario, that after failing to prevent Trump from being elected, that the operatives, either under direction of Obama or his underlings, shifted to try to limit the scope of options available to Trump as president. Another quote from Gareth Porter, who in a diplomatic way shares my skepticism about the guy who directed the investigation. Quote, "Mueller, a former FBI director who was deeply involved in justifying the Bush administration's aggressive war in Iraq, clearly shares the same political perspective and interests. Although the report makes no direct judgment about the motive behind the contacts with Russians, it is based on the implicit assumption that contacts between a presidential campaign and Russian officials are contrary to the national interest." And then Porter takes on some of the better-known incidents covered in the Mueller investigation, including the Trump Tower meeting. And he points out, as I have, that Natalia Veselnitskaya, the Russian attorney who attended, was working for Fusion GPS and used information from a case that she was working on, the case of a Russian businessman named Peter Katsev. And she had dangled the idea that she had dirt But the dirt was about the Ziff brothers. Remember Ziff, Ziff? It was Ziff-something Media. They had a bunch of tech magazines that were very popular when magazines were popular. Anyway, the Ziff brothers had engaged in tax evasion, and Veselnitskaya said some of that money wound up being passed to the Democratic Party. But she admitted in the meeting that it probably wouldn't do much damage to Hillary Clinton. Then Gareth Porter takes on the role of Felix Sater. And he reminds us that he was an FBI informant. He had been since 1998. But Mueller doesn't mention that. And he kind of skirts over whatever role Felix Sater may have played. And we know that, like what I expect Roger Stone to be facing, that he bullshitted in public and then had to defend his bullshit, and that's why he's being accused of lying to investigators. And Porter, quoting Porter here, Mueller's report shows that Michael Cohen didn't take Sater's boast seriously, that he would try to set up a meeting with Putin and be able to deliver on the Moscow hotel deal. But the most critical part for me is the British operation. And this has received very little coverage in the corporate media. But we know that this guy, Joseph Mifsud, who was director of the dubious London Academy of Diplomacy, he was probably in cahoots with Stefan Halper, with the Australian ambassador to London, Alexander Downer, and to the former head of MI6, who is a partner of Christopher Steele's, the guy who wrote the dodgy dossier. And so I think that this is a rich area that was really just mentioned in passing by Mueller, and it should have been completely investigated. And he also challenges the claim that Rachel Maddow and other mainstream media operators have been promoting that Konstantin Kilimnik, because he got polling information from Paul Manafort, and Manafort lied about that exchange in an effort, in an effort that undermined his plea deal. And so there is a lot more to this story. And to some extent, Gareth Porter reprises his previous reporting about the troll farm, the Russian Internet Research Agency, and the minimal impact I believe it had on American voters, despite the way even last week Hillary Clinton was saying, oh yeah, Russia succeeded. Look at that. They flooded and they confused American voters. And I just think that is frankly bullshit. I think that American voters, to the extent they were confused, were confused by Hillary Clinton's self-inflicted wounds and by Donald Trump's massive media coverage, the $80 million that he spent on carefully targeted ads on Facebook, much different from the laughable efforts of the IRA in St. Petersburg. And then there were the voter suppression schemes. The other piece I want to recommend to you is by Larry C. Johnson and published at Consortium News today. He goes into quite a bit of detail outlining his theories that the Mueller report provides irrefutable evidence that the so-called Russian collusion case against Trump was a deliberate fabrication by intelligence and law enforcement organizations in the U.S., the United Kingdom, and organizations aligned with the Clinton campaign. Continuing to quote here from Johnson, the New York Times reported that a man with a long history of working with the CIA and a female FBI informant traveled to London in September of 16 and tried unsuccessfully to entrap George Papadopoulos. And he's referring to Stefan Halper there. The biggest curiosity is that U.S. intelligence or law enforcement officials fully briefed British intelligence on what they were up to. Now, Larry C. Johnson has contacts in the intelligence community because he spent many years working for the CIA. And I interviewed him with Bill Binney a few months back. And this is not criticism, it's just an observation. I do see Larry C. Johnson as generally a Trump supporter. But I don't think that colors the allegations that he makes here. He says there's not a single instance where Trump or any member of his campaign team initiated contact with Russians for the purpose of gaining derogatory information on Hillary. Not one. Simply put, he says, Trump and his campaign were the target of an elaborate, wide-ranging, covert action designed to entrap him and others of his team as agents of Russia. And when it comes to Felix Sater, Larry C. Johnson says, Mueller is downright dishonest in failing to identify Sater as an FBI informant. He wasn't just a private entrepreneur looking to make some coin. He was a fully signed-up FBI informant. Sater's status as an FBI snitch was first exposed in 2012. All suggestions for meeting with the Russian government, including Putin, originated with Felix Sater. Then he turns to George Papadopoulos, describing him as targeted by British and U.S. intelligence starting in late December of 15, when out of the blue he's offered a job with the London Center of International Law and Practice Limited. And Johnson sees that as a offshoot of another company or some sort of affront. He said it's owned and run by Naghi Khalid Idris, a 48-year-old British citizen of Sudanese origin. For no apparent reason, Idris offers Papadopoulos a job as the director of his company's International Energy and Resources Division. Then in March of 16, Idris and another man, who had acted as an attorney for the FBI in a different case, insist on introducing Joseph Mifsud to Papadopoulos. Mifsud then brings a woman who he claims is Putin's niece. Her name is Olga. And a little bit later here, Johnson writes, we encounter the lying and obfuscation of the Mueller team. They falsely characterize Mifsud as an agent of Russia. In fact, he has close and long-standing ties to both British and U.S. intelligence. Then, in discussing Carter Page, he says Mueller paints Page's prior experience and work in Russia as evidence that he was being used by Russian intelligence, but says nothing about the fact that Page was being regularly debriefed by the CIA and the FBI during that period. So here we see that the omissions of Robert Mueller, failure to investigate certain angles, and kind of burying or just ignoring things in his report, suggest that he is covering up, that his report is not a full report. It's what I described as a limited hangout investigation. And Larry C. Johnson notes, as I've pointed out, Veselnitskaya was working closely with the firm Hillary Clinton hired to produce the Steele dossier, Fusion GPS. And I don't know why that doesn't get covered. Everybody knows there was a Russian lawyer. They can't pronounce her name. And it's always assumed she was there on Putin's behalf. That does not appear to be true. I don't know where this is going to lead. But the corporate media, the Democratic left, they have risked so much on Russiagate. And the blowback here could be truly severe. FBI Director Chris Wray is rebuffing the comments of his Attorney General Bill Barr that the Trump campaign was the subject of illegal surveillance or spying by the FBI. At a budget hearing for the FBI, he told senators, that's not the term I would use. And here's the voice of the New York Times. Barr's politically charged description of lawful FBI tactics has helped stoke claims that agents might have been acting wrongfully. Well, who declared that those tactics are lawful? They haven't really been evaluated. Bob Mueller took a pass on that. So you can expect the FBI director to defend the Bureau. But here's an indefensible item related to the FBI. Another frame-up of an American accused of an attempted act of terrorism. In this case, 25-year-old Adel Daoud. That's a male. And he is known to be immature and mentally diminished. Those are my words. But it's clear that when FBI agents started surveilling him when he was 18, his extreme immaturity, and clear indications of mental illness were apparent to the officers. And get this, the government wanted to sentence this guy to 40 years because they framed him with a Jeep that was supposed to be loaded with explosives. They gave him a button to push to kill a bunch of people. He pushed the button twice, and it didn't go off. Even this AP story admits agents supplied the fake device and convinced Daoud that it was real. So they wanted a 40-year term for this guy, and the judge acts as if she is compassionate by saying, I'm only going to give you 16 because you're not mentally competent. The case never should have been brought in the first place. These kinds of frame-ups, entrapment is the actual language, have no place in the American so-called justice system. So, we know about the allegations of hacking, that Russia hacked the DNC and gave it to WikiLeaks. We've heard it over and over again, and it may be behind the redactions in the Mueller report, but to date, we have no public evidence of those claims. And today, the New York Times reports that Chinese intelligence acquired NSA hacking tools and had them in 2016. And you know how they got them? They intercepted an American offensive cyber attack on a Chinese site of some sort. And they essentially took the weapon away. You know, it's like some guy comes up with a gun and threatens you, says he's going to break into your house, and you overpower him and take his weapon. Well, that's loosely what happened here. Because according to the cybersecurity firm Symantec, the Chinese didn't steal the code. They captured it from an NSA attack on their own computers. So sloppy spycraft by the United States compromised the toolbox of hacking tools that later became known as Vault 7. Now, I have to concede that there could be some difference between the hacking tool that China grabbed and what is in Vault 7. But by 2016, we know that the NSA hacking tools were dumped on the Internet and that Russia, North Korea, and China all possessed U.S.-made hacking tools. And I don't float this to confuse you. But all this blame on Russia, 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 without any public evidence, and now we learn that China had grabbed our hacking tool? There is no evidence that China attempted the hacks that have been blamed on Russia. I want to be clear about that. But as I've pointed out 1,500,000 times, you can disguise IP addresses and other indicators of who is attempting to hack into a place. And so, we have more questions than we have answers. Now, speaking of China, the trade war that Trump has engaged in is reaching a new peak after his angry tweets Sunday and Monday threatening new tariffs on China. There was concern that the lead negotiator for China, Vice Premier Liu He, would boycott the meeting. But Beijing has confirmed that he is arriving on Thursday, and he's got one day because at midnight Friday is when the threatened Trump tariffs would go into effect. So that stone wall around the White House is just getting bigger and bigger. I guess this is that big, beautiful wall that Trump dreams about. So the latest is the expanded obstruction of the White House, that they moved to stop Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, from handing over documents to the Judiciary Committee of the House under a subpoena. So this is becoming a huge legal battle between two branches of government. The White House counsel, the new one, Pat Cipollone, or Cipollone, instructed the Judiciary Committee to redirect to him its request for the records, which relate to possible episodes of obstruction of justice identified by the Mueller report. And I believe that Trump might be able to win this one. He's got this post facto claim of executive privilege, which hasn't actually been formally raised. But I think it's fair to say that somebody in such a sensitive position as White House counsel may beat the rap on being forced to testify on Capitol Hill. But when it comes to Mueller, that's a push. I don't think that his role made him, you know, an advisor to the president, and that having him testify would compromise the frankness of advice delivered to a president in the future. But that's not the only obstruction. Yesterday was the formal response from the Treasury Department and Steven Mnuchin, and he falsely claimed that he could withhold the release of Trump's tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee because the request lacks a legitimate legislative purpose, and the department is therefore not authorized to disclose the requested returns and return information. Mnuchin knows that that is flat-out bullshit. There is nothing in the law that refers to legitimate legislative purpose. And they are raising a red herring, which a court will likely strike down, but we can expect that to take months, if not years. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who subscribe to the Peter B. Collins podcast for your support. And I keep a little list here from recent PayPal payments like Cliff Johnson, Ted Kelly, Bill J., and Brian Massey. They each kick in $5 or $10 a month. You could do it too. And if you haven't, let's fix that. Just drop by peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu tab, then click on Become a Subscriber. You'll hit the sign-up page, and the options are laid out there for you. You can also choose the $50 annual subscription that earns you a bonus book. I've still got a couple of copies of this $55 beautifully produced book about climate change. It's called 2100. And I'm always trying to summon up the subtitle. It's a little tricky. I don't have it in front of me. But it is a great book, and I'd love to send you a copy. Just set up a new annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., and I'll get it out to you. So yesterday I opened the podcast by saying that I believe Trump is trying to pressure or trick the Democrats into impeachment. And as you know, I don't think it takes a trick. I think that the evidence is so strong that really it is a bad political decision to continue to hold back on impeachment. But today in New York, Nancy Pelosi kind of echoed my comments, and I'm not suggesting she listened to the podcast. She said, Trump is goading us to impeach him. That's what he's doing every single day. He's just like taunting, 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 because he knows that it would be very divisive for the country, but he doesn't really care. He just wants to solidify his base. Now, it would also solidify the Democratic base. And it might peel off some Trump supporters who say, really? I mean, that is a possibility. They're not all lunatic and demonic people who are possessed by Trump and his Twitter finger. Another quote from Pelosi, every day he's obstructing justice by saying, this one shouldn't testify, and that one shouldn't testify, and the rest. So he's making the case, but he's just trying to goad us into impeachment. And wherever you go, I say to my colleagues, whatever it is, be ready. And whatever it is, will be ready. Now, this is this kind of general blather that leaves people scratching their heads. And as the Democrats dither, the Republicans are organized, and they have a common message. And that number one GOP talking point is, hey, this is all over. The Mueller report is in, no collusion, no obstruction, it's time to move on. Case closed is the term used by Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, today. Here's the quote. With an exhaustive investigation complete, would the country finally unify to confront the real challenges before us, or would we remain consumed by unhinged partisanship and keep dividing ourselves to the point that Putin and his agents need only stand on the sidelines and watch as their job is done for them? Wow! Now, what's unhinged is that the Republicans don't have a rational argument here. On the one hand, they say no collusion and therefore Russia didn't interfere in our election, right? And then they blame Democrats for unhinged partisanship. so that Putin and his agents only need to watch as we divide ourselves. Now, that's what we've been doing, and Mitch McConnell has had a healthy role in that. And to, on the one hand, say, hey, nothing happened with the Russians, and on the other hand, say, the Democrats are, you know, so divisive that they are helping do the work of the Russians. Now, it's totally incoherent, but the Republican base doesn't hear it that way. And Schumer and Pelosi responded to this. McConnell's declaration of case closed is a stunning act of political cynicism and a brazen violation of the oath we all take. The special counsel report laid out 11 instances of the president's obstruction and left a raft of unanswered questions about coordination between the president's campaign and Russia. These are not trivial or political questions. They go to the wellspring of our democracy. Well, Jason Leopold's at it again. As you know, I deeply respect the work that he does as a journalist when it's based on accessing government documents under the Freedom of Information Act. And at BuzzFeed today, he reports that his legal efforts have forced the Justice Department to issue what I call a redaction light version of the Mueller report. And this came out of a FOIA lawsuit that was filed by Leopold and BuzzFeed in the court of Reggie Jackson, who is a former chief judge of the FISA court and who said he might want to get himself a copy of the unredacted report to see what could or couldn't be released. But the new version that was released to BuzzFeed states which information was withheld in the redactions because it would interfere with ongoing law enforcement proceedings. And it does provide a little more information, but it doesn't prove that Russia hacked the DNC and gave it to WikiLeaks. Yesterday, we reported that John Bolton, on Sunday night, grandstanding, that we're sending the aircraft carrier group Abraham Lincoln toward the Persian Gulf. Iran responded today, calling it a form of psychological warfare. And a spokesman for the Tasnim news agency, Bolton's statement is a clumsy use of a burnt-out happening for psychological warfare. Now, I don't know what a burnt-out happening is, but that was the quote from the Iranian spokesperson. And what's interesting is we now learn that the Abraham Lincoln carrier group was already on its way to the Persian Gulf. And this is just bellowing from John Bolton. A fake news report from CNN that has been revealed by the Gray Zone Project and writer Ben Norton. On May 6th, CNN published an article claiming that Venezuela's U.S.-appointed right-wing coup leader Juan Guaido had actually been elected president of his country. And anybody who pays attention knows that the election was last year. Maduro won. Guaido and his opposition party boycotted that election and then declared that it was not legitimate. And it was in January of this year that Guaido declared himself president under a passage in the Venezuelan Constitution that permits that under certain circumstances, but only for 30 days, and that is long expired. Six CNN reporters contributed to the report. And Norton writes, meaning this blatantly false claim went by at least 12 eyeballs, in addition to the company's editorial team. Yet it was still published, a clear sign that CNN's award-winning staff is either extremely ignorant about what's happening in Venezuela or confident that it can deceive the American public. The actual quote from the CNN story: pressure is mounting on Maduro to step down following elections in January in which voters chose opposition leader Juan Guaido over him for president. With media like that, we have a real problem. And again, we're seeing very little opportunity for dissent from the regime change scheme against Venezuela. And I want to point out that the only place in corporate media that I've seen voices objecting is on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox. Yeah. Today, Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, has released among 6,000 prisoners two prize-winning Reuters journalists, U Wa Lone and U Kyaw So U, were arrested in December of 2017 for honestly covering the deadly crackdown on the Rohingya minority group and the genocide and forced expulsions that followed. They won the Pulitzer Prize while they were imprisoned in the former Burma. Today, Trump issued a pardon as a sop to the far right and the military minds in our country. It's the case of Michael Behena, championed by great minds like radio host Michael Savage. And this case goes back. The Bush administration prosecuted Michael Behena, who was a lieutenant, I believe, in the Army. He was convicted of unpremeditated murder after killing a suspected Al-Qaeda terrorist in Iraq. And he's already been paroled. He got out in 2014, and he would complete his parole in 2024. But Trump issued the pardon today, despite the fact that at his trial, the testimony emerged that he was put in charge of a prisoner to take home who was being released. The prisoner was implicated in an attack on two members of Behena's platoon that led to their deaths from a roadside bomb. So Behena took this Iraqi prisoner, and he claimed that he had to kill him in self-defense. But the man was unarmed, and I've seen no testimony that would support the self-defense claim. I have mixed feelings about one candidate for president, California Senator Kamala Harris. I think that it's pretty early in her career to make this move. I don't have a clear foreign policy. I don't have a clear understanding of her foreign policy positions. And there are a few other issues that give me pause. But I want to celebrate. I want to acknowledge that Kamala Harris is the first Democratic presidential candidate who has talked about voter suppression. And we need more of this. Now, it's a little ironic to me because she spoke before the NAACP in Detroit this past Sunday. Here's the quote. Let's say this loud and clear. Without voter suppression, Stacey Abrams would be the governor of Georgia. Andrew Gillum is the governor of Florida. Not yet. So we need a new Voting Rights Act. She was there in Michigan, where the heist of Hillary Clinton took place, where 75,000 votes in Detroit and in Flint were suppressed because those voters submitted a ballot, and when they were tabulated, it showed no vote for president. And Trump carried Michigan by less than 11,000 votes. It's fair to say that that's ancient history, and the Abrams and Gillum races are more recent. Do you remember Sandra Bland? African-American woman from Chicago heading to university in Texas, stopped by Trooper Brian Encinia, and he zapped her with his stun gun. Well, he was accused of perjury at trial, but they dropped the charge in exchange for his agreeing to never work as a cop again. And the prosecutor said they weren't sure that they could really persuade a jury that he had lied. And just today, a TV station in Dallas, WFAA, it was yesterday, released footage from Sandra Bland's own cell phone video. And it contradicts the claim by Officer Encinia that he feared for his safety. She was pointing her phone at him, and he yelled at her, "Get off the phone." She said, "I'm not on the phone. I'm taking pictures of you." And to claim that that is a threatening act that required him to yank her out of the car and tase her. She was jailed and 3 days later found dead. And I personally declined to call that a suicide. Finally today, Julian Assange got a visitor at the Supermax prison where he is locked up outside London. Pamela Anderson showed up to visit him, and she had some strong comments. Now, I knew Pamela Anderson from when she was married to Tommy Lee, the leader of a bad hair band called Motley Crue, and I've never really had a positive opinion of her. I think she's more boobs than brains. But she showed up to visit Assange. She said he doesn't deserve to be in a supermax prison. She's right. He's never committed a violent act. That's true. He's an innocent person. I believe that. And she said that he's really cut off from everybody, hasn't been able to access the internet, use a library, or speak to his person. He's a good man, an incredible person. I love him. I can't imagine what he's been going through. And she wore a cape covered with text that made references to prison, tyranny, and Oliver Cromwell. Well, I have to say that elevates my impression of Pamela Anderson. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it with everyone, and you'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.